All right, let us begin this morning. We are in the book of Proverbs. It's the 20th book in the Bible. In fact, it starts off in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel." And then as you notice in your notes, I write about a page and a little bit, and a half of an introduction before we get to the next section. Let me tell you what is in that I'm not going to read that to you. I want to tell it to you. I've got a chart on the board, which I'm probably going to make into a chart on the lesson before I actually publish it. I want you to follow me now. David is born, of course, and at age 40, he becomes the king. And he will rule for 40 years, and he dies at age 80. Along the way, David ends up living in Hebron when Saul dies. Now, there's an interesting thing about this. It's not in your notes, but I'm going to tell it to you anyway. King Saul is anointed king, and within 21 days of him becoming the king recognized by all the tribes, he does something that causes the Lord to draw a line and say, "Saul, your days are numbered." The Lord is going to allow King Saul to reign for 40 years. But after that event happens in Saul's life, where Samuel has given Saul an instruction from the Lord, and Saul does not follow the instruction. In that event, Samuel goes and finds Saul, tells him what he's done wrong, and begins to leave. And Saul reaches out and grabs Samuel, and he tears Samuel's robe. And Samuel turns and says to Saul, "So shall the kingdom be ripped from your hands." After that point, Saul has moments of sanity and moments of insanity, going wishy-washy from one to another to one to another. Samuel leaves Saul and ends up at the home of Jesse, and there he finds David, the shepherd boy, and he anoints David to be the next king. David knows he is to be the next king. Over the next few years, David is sent by Jesse to take food to his brothers and also to the king, cheese and some other things. And David shows up, and as you remember, one of the times he shows up and he's looking for his brothers to deliver the cheese and the food and that stuff. And there's a Philistine that's out on the hill that's threatening them all. He's a huge guy. David says, "Why hasn't anybody approached this Philistine and done something with him?" And you know the story. That's the story where David dons the armor of Saul, and it's too heavy for him, so he takes it off. He goes down, he selects 5 smooth stones out of their creek bed, and he goes and he faces off with Goliath, and he kills Goliath. With that becomes an interesting thing, and that is that Saul invites him to be his musician to calm him whenever he's having some of these spells that come on. But it also is the point where Saul not only invites him to be his musician, but also begins to hate him. He hates David because the people are saying Saul has conquered hundreds, but David has conquered thousands. All David has done is won Goliath, but that's still what they were saying. Over the next few years, David is having to run from Saul and finally ends up in Hebron, where he is gathering wives. He really is gathering wives. In fact, in Hebron, he has 6 sons in Hebron, and he has 1 daughter: Amnon, Daniel, Absalom, Adonijah, Stephathite, or whatever, Ithream. You know, these are like Cajun names, some of them. You know, you just can't hardly say them, all right? Hebrew. And then he has Tamar. Sorry I messed that one up, but you know, we'll work on that some other time. David, when Saul dies, David does not immediately become the king of the 12 tribes. He becomes the king of the tribe of Judah, 1 tribe. Benjamin sides with the other 10 tribes. And so 11 tribes choose Ishbosheth, one of Saul's sons, to be the king. And he is king of the 11 tribes for 2 years, while David is the king for 2 years of the tribe of Judah. Finally, at the end of 2 years, two radical, rebellious men go to Ishbosheth and cut off his head and bring news to David. And David, of course, has the two radicals killed for what they've done to the king. With that, the 11 tribes join Judah and make David their king. For 7 years, David is in Hebron, and that's the capital city of the kingdom of Israel for 7 years. During that 7 years, these six sons and one daughter are born to David, and probably just a little earlier before he becomes king. David finally ends up and he conquers the citadel of Zion in Jerusalem. And it's a Jebusite fortress. And he conquers it. And he takes it over to be his home and his capital of the Israelites. That is Jerusalem. And so when he goes there, he moves there, and there he has nine sons of some of his wives and some of his concubines. It's an interesting list. In the list of nine sons, you actually see two names come up twice. They are two different sons. They're four different sons. These first two that are mentioned in the green actually die young, and when sons are born later, those names are given to the two sons that are born. So David has six sons and then nine sons, but he also has five more sons. When he has his relationship with Bathsheba, he has a son of which we know that dies unnamed, a name we don't know, so it dies as a child. Then Solomon is born. Solomon is the 10th child in the order of these sons. He is the 10th child born to David. And then there are three born to Bathsheba after Solomon. Now, let me back up. There's a son over here in the very first list. Actually, two sons. One's name is Absalom. And the other name is Amnon. The very first and oldest son of David is named Amnon. Amnon, let's say it like this, fell in love with his half-sister Tamar. But being a half-blood relative, Tamar did not really want to have anything to do with Amnon. Now, you can go back and read the story, and I wish you would. Here's the short version. Amnon tricks Tamar, saying that he is sick and he needs to be nursed back to health. And so he gets permission from his father David to allow his half-sister Tamar to come and nurse him back to health. It's all a ploy. And when she gets there, it's not very long before Amnon takes advantage of Tamar in a sexual relationship. When he's through with her, he doesn't like what has happened, and so he wants to throw her out. There's an interesting passage there with Tamar that says, no, don't throw me out, for in your throwing me out, the sin is greater than what has just happened. Well, Absalom hears what his half-brother has done to his half-sister. He is furious. He doesn't do anything right off the bat. It takes a while, maybe as much as a year and a half, and Absalom is going off to an area to where he's inviting his brothers to come join him there, and he finally gets permission from David, his father, to allow them to come. They are all there, and they're sitting around a fire, almost all of his brothers that are alive, and he takes a knife and he cuts the throat of Amnon for what he did to Tamar, and Amnon dies. With that, Absalom begins to run from his father, David. That transpires over several years. In fact, he's gone. He's hiding. David sends word to him that he forgives Absalom and asks Absalom to come back to Jerusalem. Absalom comes back, enters a house, and David doesn't come to visit him, and he doesn't go to visit David for an extended period of time, a couple of years. Finally, David forgives Absalom, and they meet up, and he offers his forgiveness for what Absalom has done. And life goes on, but Absalom becomes a rebellious son towards his father. In fact, he doesn't think his father is ruling well as a king. And he determines in himself with his friends that he is going to take over the kingdom. In doing so, David has to leave Jerusalem. David leaves Jerusalem. He's on the run from Absalom because Absalom's forces have become so great that David cannot battle him. And actually, David doesn't want to battle him. But David gathers up all of his folks with him except for 10 of his concubines, and he leaves them there to take care of the palace. And David leaves, crosses the Jordan River, and goes off to the east. In the midst of Absalom trying to catch David, in one of the events, Absalom is riding through the oak trees, and his hair catches in the oak trees and pulls him off his horse, and he's hanging in the oak trees. And the general and the men of David find him, and they run spears through Absalom, and they kill him, and it breaks David's heart. It just breaks David's heart. But Absalom is out of the way. When, over the next 6 to 8 months, David finally returns to Jerusalem to be the king, continue his kingship there in Jerusalem and rule from there, is when the event occurs where David looks over his roof and sees out of his palace, and he sees Bathsheba up on her roof taking a bath. And that is what causes David to sin greatly. He calls for that woman. Her name is Bathsheba. They have a relationship. A child is born, but the child is going to die. After that child has died, of course, her husband, Uriah, David has put him in the heat of the battle, and he has died also. And so David takes her to be his wife, and then he has Solomon. It's the second son of Bathsheba. So along the way, Solomon is born. We actually know when he's born. And Solomon grows. Solomon comes up to the age of 30. David is on his bed. Now, we're not calling it him being on his deathbed. He is elderly. He is sick. And his sickness is progressing so long that they have to acquire a woman, a young woman who has never been married, who they take. She's a Shunammite. And she comes and she becomes the nurse of David to care for him. Now, it's just the way it is today as it was back then. When we become old and elderly and we can't get around and we can't make it to the bathroom and we can't feed ourselves, people are brought in to take care of us, or we are sent out to be taken care of. Nothing is different except for this is a king who needs a person to take care of them. And in doing so, in that culture, she is considered a wife of David. She is a beautiful woman, according to the scriptures. So over a period of time, she is caring for David. Even during this period of time, David is, when David is really not able to get up and move around, he is still the king. And it's kind of interesting because he has promised Bathsheba that Solomon will be the king that follows him. Well, one day along the way, when David is not doing well, this Adonijah of the first set of sons born in Hebron decides that he is going to be king. So he gets the priest to anoint him as king, and they start having a party. When the party breaks out that night, the word gets to Bathsheba that Adonijah has been crowned king, and she is disturbed. She goes with Nathan, the prophet, who, by the way, David will have a son, David's last son by Bathsheba is named after this prophet Nathan. These are not the same Nathans. There's a prophet Nathan, and then this son is named after Nathan. This is the line, Nathan, this is the line of which his descendants will run to Mary, the mother of Jesus. Anyway, Nathan the prophet and Bathsheba go in at separate times, and they tell David, and David finally says, take Solomon tonight and anoint him as king and send word to Adonijah. Sure enough, that's what happens. And whenever Adonijah hears what has happened, he is devastated, but he realizes that's the king's wishes. So he bows out. For a period of time, Solomon and David co-rule as king. But Solomon's 40 years has not begun during that co-rule. That just doesn't work out in the math. So Solomon has been anointed king, but he has his co-rule really hasn't started. And even though I've got his age 30 here, when David dies, he is 30 years of age. And that's when he truly becomes the king, even though he's anointed just before. So this chart's not exactly right. David will die at the age of 80. Solomon will take over. He rules for 40 years. We don't need that up there. And then he'll finally die at the age of 70. There's an interesting little story that's not in your lesson here, but I want to tell it too. Solomon becomes king, and Adonijah, who wanted to be king, wants something else. It's in 1 Kings, the first chapter of 1 Kings. The beautiful woman who has really been a wife to David to take care of his needs, but the marriage was never consummated, is extremely beautiful, and Adonijah wants her to be his wife. He goes to Bathsheba and he says, Bathsheba, I want you to ask something of your son, the king. I want you to ask Solomon if he will allow me to take that Shunammite woman and young girl and make her my wife. Bathsheba goes to Solomon and says, Solomon, my son, I have a request of you. Oh, mother, whatever you ask, it shall be yours. I will move the world, in other words, for whatever you ask. It shall be done. And Bathsheba says, would you permit that Adonijah take the Shunammite woman of your father to be his wife? And of course, Solomon looks at her in his moral righteousness, his godliness, and says, mother, I wish you'd have asked me for anything else in the world except for that. Because I cannot give her to him because she does not belong to me to give to him because she is the unconsummated wife of my father. She must wait until my father comes for her, in other words. And in the faith of the Jewish faith at that point in time, any marriage where a consummation of the marriage has not occurred, the wife is never free to marry anyone else at all. Thus, Solomon will sit down and he will write a song about it, a beautiful song. It is actually a play called the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. And it's about the Shunammite woman who has fallen in love with a man. The marriage, there is no marriage yet. She is waiting for the marriage to happen, and she's waiting for her beloved to come back and take her on to be with him where he has gone off. Solomon, according to the scripture, wrote over 3,000 proverbs and 1,005 songs or plays. The only one we have is the Song of Songs that is in our Bible. So that gets the first page. We can turn to the next page. All that. And we will go over that another time. Now, Proverbs chapter 1 through 29 belong to Solomon. Proverbs 29 does not belong to Solomon. It belongs to another man. And in fact, I mean, 30 belongs to another man, and 31 belongs to a different man. The last two Proverbs in the book of Proverbs do not belong to Solomon. They are authored by two other people. And we will get to that when we get to those chapters, and we'll discuss those men and what we know about them and why those Proverbs are actually included in the Proverbs with Solomon's Proverbs when we get to that. So we ask the question, what is a proverb? Well, quickly, here's what a proverb is. A proverb in Scripture is a short statement that is truth, accurate truth, that is usable in many different circumstances, situations that may come our way. Little snippets that you need to learn ahead of time, so when something dangles out in front of you that might be a sin of some sort, you know to run from it because of the little proverb that you have heard. My father had one that was very interesting. My father's proverb was different than the proverb that we sang as little kids. We would sing when little kids would say something to us, "Nanny, nanny, boo, boo, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me, nanny, nanny, nanny." Did y'all ever hear that one? Okay. My father's proverb about that was opposite of that. He said, "Son," he says, "bricks and sticks can all be fixed, but be assured, words can surely hurt you." Now, which one is true and which one is false? That one's true. What you say, I guarantee you, can change the course of your life, and it can never be repaid. Ask any of our presidential candidates. Things can be said to a spouse, to a relative, to a brother, to a sister, to a child that can never be forgiven, even though you try and try and try. As far as bricks and sticks, they can all be fixed. They can. Tear it down and build it again. It can all be fixed. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Yeah, okay. No, I like the other. That's a proverb of my father. Perhaps we will find one close to that in the Proverbs as we go through them. Well, in the introduction to this book, the Proverbs, actually, Proverbs 1 through 29 are granted and given. They are part of Solomon's instruction. But the true Proverbs that we think of being Proverbs do not begin until chapter 10. Up until chapter 10, chapters 1 through chapter 9, Solomon is trying to convince his son. And Solomon only has one son. His name is Rehoboam. He has two sisters. Now, Solomon has another child, but we do not know whether it was a boy or whether it was a girl. And that child is a child with the Queen of Sheba, who came to be in his palace with him. Now, Solomon has a whole bunch of wives and a whole bunch of concubines, like 700 wives and 300 concubines. And they call this man the wisest man in the world, if you get my point. The Bible only records the three children that we know by name and one other. Now, surely with all those wives and all those concubines, there probably was some other children, just as they were with David. David's nine he has in Jerusalem. Some of them we know their mothers, but some of them are from concubines. Well, with Solomon, he probably does have, we can assume he has with all those wives, but we also need to realize that many of those marriages were marriages of aligning his kingdom with other kingdoms. And the truth is, for Israel, the most peaceful time in the nation of Israel was during the reign of Solomon. After Solomon dies, there is no peace between the nation of Israel and with the nation of Israel. Before Solomon becomes king, there really is no peace, even during David's reign. There's constant turmoil, constant fighting. The reason why David does not get to build the temple for the Lord is because David has too much blood on his hands. So David wants to build this temple anyway, and at least he's going to do it in his mind. And lo and behold, he cries out whenever the word comes that he can't build the temple and that Solomon will build the temple. He says, well, Lord, I want to be able to take care of this, some of these details anyway. And there's a very interesting statement. It's in the middle of the largest paragraph on page 2. You'll see 1 Chronicles 22:5 right in the middle of that page. Here's what David says about Solomon. My son Solomon is young and inexperienced, and the house that is to be built for the Lord shall be exceedingly magnificent, famous, and glorious throughout all the lands. Therefore, now I will make preparation for it. So David says, I'm going to make preparation for it because Solomon is too young and inexperienced. Okay, I got a question for you. How many of you have just worried yourself to death about your children if they're ever going to grow up? Did you ever have that thought? Are they ever going to grow up? Are they ever going to get to where they think like a mature person? Now, folks, all of us who have kids, we've done that. We've done that. On my next question, did any of your parents ever think that about you? Surely. They thought it about you. Are they ever going to grow up? Oh, my soul, the mistakes they're making. They're making this mistake. They're making that mistake. Oh, how are we going to get through this hard? If we can just get them grown. What does that mean? We've got some people who have kids that are in their 50s, and they're still saying, if we could just get them grown, you know, just get them to start thinking right. And for most of our kids, they got grown, and they turned out great. Now, not all of our kids turned out great. Some of our kids in this classroom turned out to be terrible. But they're still alive and there's still an opportunity for them. Hopefully, they will not go to the point where it's too late, where the Lord says, okay, we're done. It is over. The time is over. Well, in the Proverbs, chapters 1 through 29, when we started chapter 10, we're going to start really with the Proverbs. Now, we've got some hints of them in the first 9 chapters. But in chapter 10, verse 1, and you'll see it right there in the middle of your page. Here's an example. I should have put a little ellipsis there because it says the Proverbs of Solomon to start off this. He says, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. Now, let me just warn you, when we get to chapter 10, you're going to get sick of hearing that word that is right in the middle of that sentence, the conjunction, but. You're going to get tired of it because if you will just go scan chapter 10 through 29, every single proverb has that conjunction in it that's taking you to to one side or the other. Sometimes a proverb starts off on the dark side, the evil side, and ends up on the godly side. Sometimes it starts on the godly side and ends up on the evil side. Sometimes it talks about it. It's always going to be a comparison. Here, let me just go ahead and tell you what this is. Here he is showing to you as a son, because these are written to his son Rehoboam, by the way. He is saying, son, if you'll listen to your father, make you glad. If you don't listen to your mother, it's going to make her really sad. It's going to grieve her. That's what he's saying there. He's doing the antithesis of the father and the mother relationship, which is going to be in chapter 9 in context. The first 9 chapters is a plea to his son to get in line and to learn what Solomon has to say to his son about how to be holy and moral and godly and righteous and with justice and equity and discernment and understanding and wisdom. And evidently, we're going to see even in this lesson, the son just doesn't want to hear it from dad. Now, how interesting is that? Yet Solomon is pleading, Son, please learn wisdom and understanding and discernment and justice and righteousness. Learn it from me so you won't make these mistakes. And then before we get through with the lesson, he's going to say, you didn't listen to me. You called and I couldn't come. You finally got in trouble and all I can do is just laugh and say, I told you so. Now, did your parents ever say, I told you so? Did they? Did they ever say to you, if you do this, this is what's going to happen? And it happened. And then they say, I told you so. Well, that's what's going to happen in this lesson. What's the purpose? The purpose is actually set forth here. Chapter 1, verse 2. It says, to know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, equity. Wise behavior, righteousness, justice, equity. That's four things to receive in the instruction. To give prudence to the naive. What's a naive? To the youth, knowledge and discretion. I wish my little chart had ended up on one page, but it didn't. I didn't notice that till after I printed it. But here's what we can say. Those short three verses are addressing three categories or groups. One's a group of people, one's an action that's going to happen, and one is the result if it's done. And so we can start here with the very first one. The person that he's talking to is you and whichever one of you it is, but the reality he's talking to his son, Rehoboam, but you can put this into your camp too because you need him. You are to know, that's the action, and what the knowing will result in is wisdom. You are also to know instruction. Know is the action, and instruction is what you're going to get. You are to get the action of discernment, and that is going to give you understanding. You're going to receive information that's going to help you in wise behavior. You're going to receive information that's going to help you in righteousness. You're going to receive information that's going to help you in justice and receive information that's going to help you in equity. Now, to the naive, they're going to be given something. They're going to be given some information that's going to allow them to have prudence. What does prudence mean? To the youth, they're going to be given information that's going to help them have knowledge. What does knowledge mean? To the youth also, they're going to be given information that helps them with discretion. That's where we have broken down and we have charted out what's in those three verses. Well, there's words there that Solomon is using that we need to understand what those words mean. Know wisdom and instruction under that heading there in your lesson. We often think about the word wisdom and we think, oh, they're intelligent. I got news from you. Some of the wisest people I know and have known in my life do not have more than a third grade education. There was a deacon at my church at Laird Hill Baptist Church that he only had a third grade education. But I'm telling you, had he gotten a full education, he would have been one of the foremost probably physicists or engineers in the world because he was absolutely brilliant. Brilliant. Now, all his brilliance came by hard knocks, by the way. He had learned his lessons. He knew things because of things he had messed up in the past. Because he was one of these get-on-the-go guys, and he just did lots of things. And he worked in the oil patch. And by the way, he was in his 80s. When he was at my church, he died while I was at that church, and that was back in 1976. So he had lived in Kilgore and worked through all that oil patch time and all that time going out. In fact, he gave me a job. It was a wonderful little job. Out there in those oil patches around Kilgore, they have these things that look like little pony horses that go up and go down. Just go up and go down. Up and down. He said to me, to help me with a little extra money, he said, son, you like a job? I got a job. I got a job, Mr. Marshall. I'm minister of music here, and I'm going to school also. He said, I got a job you can do to make you a little bit more money, and I probably even can double your wages if you'll do this job right. And I said, okay, well, what is it? He said, son, come on and go with me. So he took me out to one of these little things just going up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And they have this little thing right there beside them that you put grease in that keeps that little rod greased. He said, son, every Saturday morning I want you to get up. I want you to take this can of grease. Here's the little shed where you get it out of. And for every single one of these, and he pointed them all out to me, I want you to go put, and I want you to fill that little thing up with grease, and I'll pay you $2.25 for every one you do. Holy smokes, I was only making $75 a month at that point in time, and it was a true blessing. His wife continued that job, by the way, after they left, and I did not know that until many, many years later that they were the largest tithers to the church. Because the oil companies were giving them more than that to put that grease in there. You know why? Because if you didn't grease it, there was going to be some major problems. And so that's how I made some money. He was intelligent. That's not what the word wisdom here means. In the Proverbs, I want you to always remember the word wisdom here means moral, godly thoughts. Moral, godly thoughts. Thoughts, moral qualities. Moral means to be ethical, honest, good, right, decent, proper. That's how Solomon is using the word moral. For the contrast to morality throughout this book of Proverbs is foolishness. And foolishness to Solomon is godlessness, being ungodly. So each proverb that Solomon writes is a little snippet of wisdom that is a gift from God to keep you out of trouble. But you got to know them to keep out of trouble. Here too, we can grasp our definition today of instruction like the word wisdom. And we're going to miss Solomon's intent because we think instructions is like, okay, we get these Christmas presents for our kids and we got to put them together. And so when we get in trouble, we go grab the instructions to try to find out why we goofed up putting this bicycle together. Do you know in my early years in Helping Hands, I literally got lots of phone calls on Christmas Eve when the kids had gone to bed and they were needing help putting their stuff together. I received one 2 years ago that said, Dr. Jim, we got this problem. We've got this thing for our child and we can't get it together and we think we've messed it up. Can you come help us? And I said, oh, I would love to come help you, but I'm 305 miles away from you. I think you're going to just have to make do and, you know, get out the instructions, take it apart. Now, folks, I understand all this. The first time I got something out and didn't read the instructions, I messed it up. I really messed it up. But it doesn't take long if you're continually putting stuff together till you keep seeing the same type of parts come up and you know where they fit because they all fit in the same place. Oh, they may be a different color. They may be a different size, but they all fit in the same thing. And my problem is with the instructions, I don't go to the instruction manual until I need to go to the instruction manual where I've hit a bump. And usually I don't mess anything up before I hit the bump because I get to a point and I go, okay, I've never seen this before. I better go get the instructions. Yesterday was so frustrating to me. I wanted to sheetrock my garage. And so I needed 10 sheets of sheetrock. I got that on Thursday night. I went out yesterday, and in about 35 minutes, I hung all 10 sheets of sheetrock. I am ready to float and tape. I mean, it is just, I've gone around the door. I've gone around the, this is not a hard thing to me. I can do that with my eyes blindfolded. I don't even hardly have to use a tape measure because I can pretty much eyeball the cuts and everything around the doors. I mean, I've done it so much. I mean, my wife just detests me because we can go out looking for furniture and I can tell her how wide, how big something is without the tape measure. And then the, you know, sales lady comes and, well, yeah, you're right. Okay. You know, I can do that. But then it happened. I needed to move my 1934 hot rod back into the garage. And so I went to lift the door, and you know what happened to the door? It came off the track. That little wire thing came off. Now, I have been warned by people all my life, and I have never messed with a garage door because everybody says they're dangerous. There have been people killed by that little spring on the garage door. So I have kept my distance from it. 35 minutes to hang 10 sheets of sheetrock, get ready to float and tape, and 2.5 hours of looking at that thing, trying to figure it out, going, where is the instructions for this thing? Finally, I figured it out. Finally, like to wore me out going up and down a stepladder, trying to figure out how to do this thing. Wished for instruction. It's too late. That's not what Solomon's talking about. This instruction is not to be instruction after the fact. This is to be instructions that you know ahead of time. Each proverb is about moral thoughts that are to be inside of you before any physical action takes place. You are to know when something is coming your way, the moral thought, the instruction, so that it directs you prior to you acting on something. Acting foolishly. Any of y'all ever acted foolishly? The other day, about 3 weeks ago, I mean, I warn people this stuff all the time. And when it comes down to me, I don't even take my own advice. I have told people, never give out your credit card on the phone. If they don't have your information and can't tell you everything, including the account number and the whatever, do not give out your credit card. Do not give out your social security. Don't give out anything. Please not. My DirecTV doesn't work. My remote. So I pick up the phone, DirecTV, 1-800-DIRECTV. DirecTV answers. How can I help you? After I went through a whole bunch of things, I need technical help. And they send me over to this place that says, you need to buy a warranty and we will send you out a new remote because your remote is broken. And as we're going through, I'm getting this uneasy feeling. And I finally say to them, don't you have my account number there? You mean you can't apply this to my monthly bill and me pay for it? Oh, no, you need to pay $79.95 for this warranty. And I'm going, this doesn't sound right. And if you'd been in my office, I'd said, run. I'm here going, nah, it's probably okay. It's never okay. When I don't take my own advice, I always get burned. Sure enough, I give them my credit card number, and they're going to send me new remotes because my remote's broken. And I hang up, and inside of me swells this, you have just been taken. You foolish, unwise, undiscerning, uninstructed, unintelligent slob of a person. I pick up the phone again. I call 1-800-DIRECTV again. But this time, I thought, what had happened was the DirecTV thing was coming across the TV. You know, it's not working, so it's coming across the TV. And I had dialed Direct, D-I-R-E-C-T, TV. And I thought, they don't have two T's in DirecTV. So I dialed 1-800-DIRECTV with one T. And I went through and got the technical person. They said, oh, yeah, we can help you with that. Grab the mute button, push it down, then push the enter button, hold it down till the little thing comes on the screen. It's going to reset your RF, then you punch OK, and you'll be fine. Okay, here I'm doing it. Okay, thank you very much. Can we help you any other way? No, that's fine. I went, I have been taken. I call American Express. I have just been taken. Sir, we understand. We thank you for being a loyal customer since 1979. We're going to cancel your card right now, and we'll send you another one. I got the card canceled. Another one on the way. I called back the first person, 1-800-DIRECTV. And said, I'm not buying that policy. I said, you've taken me for a look. Where are y'all out of? Well, we're in Indonesia. I'm a fool. Now, had that been you talking to me, I'd have known exactly what to tell you. Me, I bit it. So what I'm trying to say to you is, I don't care how wise you are, we're going to goof up. All right. We don't have wisdom. Discern. Do what? That's right. They know you by name. That's right. All right. Well, going on under his words, discerning sayings of understanding. To discern in Solomon Proverbs means to mentally or to separate mentally or distinguish between teachings and those of others. You got that? Teachings and those of others. To separate the teachings of the Lord from the teachings of the world. Now, folks, we've got a lot of problems with this because there are many teachings of the world that are doing it in religious names, but they're not teachings from God. And he wants us to discern those things, and he wants to have us an understanding, which means that we gather inside of us a divine knowledge of what pleases God in that understanding. It says to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and equity. Well, wise behavior is, you know what that is behaving correctly. Wisdom that teaches and attaches to how we live. Righteousness for Solomon means doing the things that are morally right. We'll turn the page. Legally correct. Justice for Solomon is something that doesn't come from an earthly throne, but it comes from the throne of God on high. And equity. Equity, as far as Solomon is, it means evenness. It's straightforward. It's a sweet equality that is ordained by the Lord for those who are his disciples. And those who study Solomon's Proverbs will receive these four things. And then he picks up with the naive. The word naive is very interesting. We think of naive as someone today, as someone who is unlearned, inexperienced, childlike, innocent, doesn't know better. That's not what Solomon is talking about. The word naive, as Solomon is using it, means that they are susceptible. That means that they are seducible. You got it? Seducible. And in fact, when Solomon says about the naive a little bit on down, he's gonna say, how long will the naive be love simplicity? And the word simplicity is the same word as the word naive. In other words, how long will the seducible love to be seduced? And so he's saying to these who are seducible, and evidently his son is seducible, as most teenagers are seducible. I promise you they are. And so he wants to get them past that. He wants the Proverbs to be a gift to them, to where they're not seducible and they can discern the truth of the Lord before they do something wrong. He's to give the youth knowledge and discretion. Here, what does it mean to know? For Solomon, a youth is anyone from birth, infancy, all the way through adolescence. The gift that is given here is an awareness of new things that they may encounter as they grow in the process of life, and to give them and provide them with discretion that allows them to keep the youth away from mischievous things, away from lewd and wicked thoughts. I have a very dear friend that's in this room right now, so I'm not going to mention the name, but on Friday we were talking. And on Friday we were talking about what we did when we were kids. And he said, oh yeah, Dr. Hastings, when I was a kid, I got into all sorts of mischief and bad things and everything. And I said, let me ask you a question. Did you know that they were wrong when you did? Oh yeah, I knew they were wrong. I knew they were wrong and just did them anyway. I said, really, did you? I mean, you knew that you're, oh yeah, I knew I was going to get caught. And I knew I was going to get a whooping. And I knew that sometimes I'd get a whooping, but, you know, every once in a while I even got a whooping when my sister sure got the whooping, but I got a whooping instead for doing these. You did them on purpose. Solomon is saying here that if you take these Proverbs and you understand them, you will not be guilty of those things because you will run from those things. You will not do something because that you know is wrong because you will have a little saying in your head that will lead you away from that. So he goes on to say, a wise man will hear an increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. To understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise and their riddles. Riddles is really an interesting word here. The word riddle means dark sayings. In other words, what he's saying is you'll have a knowledge if you learn these things. And what I'm telling you, son, you'll learn these things. You will have knowledge and you'll have wisdom and you'll have learning, you'll have understanding, and you will not be tricked up by the dark sayings that will come your way. Those riddles he's talking about. He goes on to say the fear of the Lord. The word fear there is not a good word for us. The word fear does not mean to be afraid. It means to worship. The worship of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Interesting. You want to have true wisdom and knowledge, you worship the Lord and you follow his instructions. If you do not, you are a fool, and foolishness means godlessness, that you are ungodly. He says, hear, my son, there's the word. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. Listen to what I'm giving you too. Indeed, they are graceful wreaths to your head and ornaments about your neck. Listen to what I've taught you, son, and it'll be like a crown on your head. Listen to what your mother has said, and it will be like this necklace, this beautiful and adorned around your neck. Unbelievable if you will just do these things. It's kind of interesting. My question in the next thing that we're going through here, my question is how did Solomon learn all these things? He's begging his son to follow him and to listen to him. But I wonder who was the what? Tutor, the ringtail tutor, and as you say, who is the worse, the son, Rehoboam, or Solomon? How do we know these things? How does Solomon know everything? Because he has had to have some experience. Because remember, even his father David said he was young and inexperienced. How did he become so wise? Most of us learn the things we learn by experience. I can take you out and show you how to drive all day long, but until I put you behind the wheel and let you run over some bumps, you're not going to learn to drive. I can show you how to write a paper all day long, but until I turn it over to you and give you the pen or the typewriter, do we do typewriters anymore, or the word processing on your computer, you're not going to know how to do it. You're just not going to know how to do it. I can show you, I can sample for you how to build a corner on a wall out of tubifores and to how to do it properly. But chances are, whenever I leave you after I've showed you how to do that once or twice, you're still not going to know how to do it. I could stand up here and teach you all day long, but until you take the lesson home and start reading it over and over again and start conjuring up through your mind, you're not really going to learn it. What I'm saying to you is going to fly by. Just phew, it goes in one of our ears and right out the other. It's not. You're not going to grasp it. And I understand that. Verse 7, in fact, is very interesting here. When we begin to learn to worship the Lord, that's when true knowledge is going to come. So in our worshiping, we study the Scripture. Solomon had learned from both his father and from his mother Bathsheba. In fact, verse 7 is taken from his father David, and that's found over in Psalms 111:10. It's directly out of Psalms 111:10. He's taken the words of his father to make an example that we need to learn from our parents. We're not to skip over these important things about wisdom and instruction. If we do, we miss the point. The fools despise wisdom. They despise instruction. And I have seen many of those in my lifetime. Fools that despise. Fools that despise. And then in my office, they end up back in my office because they're unhappy about something. And I will say to them, you remember I told you, if you do not do it this way and you let someone else do it for you, you are going to be unhappy. And now you are, I know I'm unhappy. Then you're going to have to learn to live with your choice because you chose opposite of my counsel. That's not to say that I always give good counsel. I try to. But in some of these cases, after you've said the same thing about 1,500 times and it's always worked, then probably it's going to work the next time too. In verse 8, Solomon makes his plea for his son. My son, he's actually going to use it 15 times in the first 9 chapters. My son, please do this. Let's pick up on that, what he's going to say. He says, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, even whole as those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious wealth. We shall fill our house with spoil. Throw in your lot with us, and we shall have one purse. That is a perfect example of how a gang group, be the Bloods or the Crips or whoever they are, enlist other kids to be part of their group. Come on, we're going to have wealth. We're going to do it. We're going to lie in wait. We're going to steal. We're going to get money. We're not going to have to work for it. We're going to have guns. We're going to have all this good stuff. Look what he says, verse 15. My son, do not walk in the way of them. Keep your feet from the path, for their feet run to evil, and they hasten to shed blood. Indeed, it is useless to spread the net in the eyes of any bird. In other words, it's useless to be part of that. Don't put your net out when you're trying to catch a bird. He said, don't do that type of stuff with what they're saying for you to do. But they lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who gains by violence. It takes away the life of its possessor. In other words, let me just put that in plain English. You go join one of those groups and you will lie, you will steal, you will kill, and lo and behold, you may gain a little wealth, but guess what? Some other group that also lies and steals and kills to gain wealth is going to come and get you. Come and get you, and they're going to kill you. You're going to die by the same means of which you're killing other people. So it is with the mafia. So it is with the mafia. There are no true friends in the mafia because everybody's having to watch their back to make sure that the person that they are so-called friends and comrades with is not seeking to kill them for some reason that they have killed someone else. Not so for those of us who live in truth and wisdom and morality. Solomon's warning his son about being captured in this. He doesn't want him to be captured in these things. Evidently, his son is being enticed by these sinners. We're going on here. It goes on to say in verse 20, wisdom shouts from the streets. She lifts her voice in the squares. Wisdom is called a her, by the way, in Proverbs. You'll see Solomon using, when he talks about her, he's talking about wisdom. He says, she lifts her voice in the square. At the head of the noisy street, she cries out. At the entrance of the gate in the city, she utters her sayings. What are her sayings? We'll get to that in just a moment. What are her sayings? She shouts, she screams, wisdom, true morality from God. In other words, I have yet, and as an example, I have yet to meet someone who has come out of a homosexual lifestyle that will not tell me, I knew it was wrong when I started it. I have yet to meet someone who robbed a bank who will not tell me, I knew it was wrong when I did it. I have yet to meet a young couple who having a baby out of wedlock that will not say to me in the conversation, even without me asking, we knew it was wrong when we did it. Wisdom shouts. And the sad thing about it is, all these people who know it's wrong, they know it's wrong because wisdom is shouting at them. They know it's wrong. In fact, we have some Muslim friends that are now Christians who used to do terrible things, and even they have professed to me they knew it was wrong when they were doing it in the name of Allah. They still knew it was wrong. And I will tell you today and what's going on in our world today, those people who are doing those dreaded things, they know it's wrong because wisdom shouts from the streets. What is wisdom saying? Wisdom is saying, 22a, how long, O naive one, will you love simplicity? How long, O seducible, that's the word there. How long, O seducible one, are you going to continue to be seduced? 22b, how long, O scoffers, are you going to delight in scoffing? Scoffers themselves love to scoff. 22b, that should be 22c, and how long will fools hate knowledge? Those are questions. How long? How long? How long? How long? Number 4 says this, verse 23. Turn to my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit on you, and I will make my words known to you. Have you ever heard that before? I think you have. It's over in Isaiah. Isaiah is not alive yet, by the way. When Solomon's writing this, Isaiah is not alive. But Isaiah 11:2 is going to give us that same thought with the same results. Lo and behold, the Gospels is going to give that same thought with the same results. Lo and behold, even in Paul's writings and Peter's writings, the same thought comes out with the same results. If you will turn and you will listen to the reproof, to the chastising that's coming for what you're doing wrong, then that spirit of that truth and moral knowledge and quality of God will just engulf you. And it'll make the words known to you so that you will fly away from anything that comes that is leading you down some ugly path. 24 says, because I called. Oh, listen to this. See if you hadn't heard this before too. Because I called and you refused. I stretched out my hand and no one paid attention. And you neglected all my counsel and you did not want my reproof. I will even laugh at your calamity. I will mock you when your dread comes. And when your dread comes like a storm and your calamity comes on like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish comes on you, then they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me, because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would not accept my counsel. They spurned all my reproof. So they shall eat of the fruit of their own ways and be satiated with their own devices. For the waywardness of the naive, that's the what? Naive is what? Seducible. So the waywardness of the seducible shall kill them, and the compliance of the fool shall destroy them. Okay, let me interpret that for you. This is real easy. What is he saying? He's saying to his son, if you don't listen to me, if you don't listen to my instruction, there's going to come a time whenever you're going to do something and I cannot help you. You're going to call for me and I cannot help you. You're going to ask. In fact, there's going to come a time whenever you're going to do something, I'm going to say, son, I told you so. I told you so. And then all I can sit back is going, yeah, son, I told you it's going to happen that way. I'm glad you didn't get burned so bad. But there also will come a time, as he continues on in that passage, where he says, look, there's going to come a time when there is no returning back. When you want to call for daddy and daddy cannot come help. It was just a few weeks ago that a call came to me at 11:30 at night that said, my daughter has been picked up by the sheriffs and they're in Harris County Jail. She's there. Can you help me? What do I do? And I tried not to laugh, and I did not laugh where the mother could hear. But inside, I'm going, yeah, I know this child. How many times did we warn her that this was coming? How many times did we say to her, but I didn't say, we told you so. I've never said that to the girl because she already knows that we had told her so. We had told her so many times. And I said to the mother, I said, well, Mom, what I want you to do is I want you to go into your kitchen. I want you to go get out. You like hot tea. I want you to make you a good cup of hot tea. Get some of that chamomile stuff that kind of makes you sleepy. And get you a good night's rest. Because your daughter is out of the availability of me to help or anyone to help your daughter tonight. I said, I'm going to make a phone call down there. And I'm going to see where we are. While you're making your tea, I'll call you back. So I make a phone call. Sure enough, I get hold of somebody only because I was able to say, I'm Jim Hastings. I'm minister at Sagemont Church. I understand so-and-so is there. Can you just tell me where she is in the process so I can calm the mother down? And the sheriff said, well, she's sitting in holding, and she probably will not be able, because of the big backup in the line, be able to be even booked in until mid-morning tomorrow. I said, okay. So I hung up and called mother. I said, okay, mid-morning tomorrow, she'll be finally booked in. And sometime tomorrow, she will go before a judge. And after that, we will know what we can do to help your daughter. But there's nothing we can do right now. She's out of she can call for mama with that free one call all she wants, but mama cannot come help. She can call for daddy all she wants, but daddy cannot come help. Because they have girded her up and taken her where she does not want to go. And the scriptures told us about that too over in the New Testament. Lord Jesus told us that thing. And that's what's happened to her. But this came after 3 years of warning. You're headed down a path. Daughter, if you will listen to the things we're telling you, you will not end up in jail. She was bent on ending up in jail. because of the things that she loved, she favored to be the things that she loved to do that were illegal. Oh, they're legal in Colorado. It's legal in Oregon. It's going to be legal here one day. Yeah, but it's not. And you're going to end up in jail. I was just minding my own business, minister. Lo and behold, and a sheriff came up and knocked on my window. I'm just glad my car wasn't running. Because then it would have been driving while intoxicated or drugged or whatever it is. She said, I was doing my own business in my own car with the car off in the parking lot and he knocked on my window. How fair is that? Fair, if you ask me. Fair. She called. No one can come help us. Folks, there's going to come a time, and we know these words. These words we're going to find all over in the New Testament. We're going to find these in Paul's writings. We're going to find these in the writings of the church. There comes a time when, if you make poor choices, there is no one to rescue you because the Lord has said, enough is enough. Verse 33 says this, but he who listens to me shall live securely and shall be at ease from the dread of evil. Son Rehoboam, if you will just listen to these things, perk up your ears, learn the things I'm about to tell you, I promise you, you will live at ease. Because the opposite of that, if we want to make a proverb out of it, if you're not living in ease, you're living in turmoil. And evidently, either Solomon lived in turmoil, which we know he did for a while, or Rehoboam is really living in turmoil, and Solomon is trying to keep his son from making the same mistakes. Well, with that, we're going to pick up in chapter 2 next week of the Proverbs as we move on through. Lord Jesus, we thank you for the glorious time of just listening. May we not be susceptible and seducible to the evil that is around us. May we not be naive in that. May we not be like the youth who want to try and fly our wings. Oh, I know most of us in here are older, but we still have those tendencies. May we learn true wisdom, moral, godly qualities that allow us not to sin when we're dealing with our families and with relationships and the people around us. Lord, it's all about relationships. Lord, we love you for these scriptures. In your name, amen. Should I say, go and sin no more?